Welcome to Season 3, Episode 4 of Swift Over Coffee. I'm Paul Hudson.
And I'm Michaela Caron.
And in this episode, we discuss what's the worst code you've ever written. And a PHP code would generate JavaScript code. And the JavaScript code would generate HTML code.
We ask folks, do developers also need to be designers?
Developers often think that they use software like an average person. We don't. We don't use software like an average person.
Plus, when it's right, like when it's great, you're like, yeah, feels fantastic. So at last, after a long summer break, I'm back from vacation, having had a wonderful time in Japan and across Europe. I think you're just about to go on vacation.
Yeah, we keep alternating back and forth ever since DubDub. I am about to head over to Paris to go to the Swift Connection conference.
Oh, great choice. Nice event too.
Yes, I'm super excited. I haven't been to Europe yet. I went to London last year for server-side Swift. Okay, does that count? I was told I wasn't sure if it counts anymore.
True. Yeah, so obviously while you're in Paris, there's stacks to see the sightseeing too. You gonna try and do some sightseeing as well, do you think?
Yes, I'm gonna go early because I'm thinking if I go early before the conference starts, then I don't have jet lag or anything. Mm. So then I'm already like on the time zone and then I can do like sightseeing, all sorts of stuff, and possibly visit a Vision Pro Lab while I'm over there.
Ooh, yeah. We'll see. I've been seeing a lot of folks posting they've been to Vision Pro Labs in, I think, Munich, London, Cupertino, Singapore, Tokyo.
Shanghai.
Yep. Yeah, there's a handful around. None on the East Coast, weirdly, or the US or Canada. Just Cupertino across all of North America. In fact, all across both Americas, really.
Yeah.
But the feedback has been obviously censored very carefully. They can't say very much. But what they can say has been hugely positive. Have you seen this as well?
Yes, I've seen people, because I saw one person, I can't remember who it was, who was like, I went to a Vision Pro lab today. I can't tell you anything. Or it was also, I went to a Vision Pro lab. It was redacted.
Yeah. We won't know what happens inside, but certainly what they've been saying, apart from the details, has been, it was great. You should go for it.
Yeah, it looks super fun. And everybody, like all the user interactions, because that's what I've been asking about, is like, how was it actually using the device? Not so much like, what did it look like kind of thing? Because we all kind of know what that is. But like, how does it feel really using it and like getting to run something that like you're actually making too?
So you're planning to go along because you've got something to show off now? Your code's getting ready-ish?
Somewhat-ish. I announced the last episode or one before that, we were talking about all of our Vision Pro app ideas. And the one I wanted to make was a life-size chess. So my goal is to be like, you're in Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone or Philosopher's Stone, because they renamed it in America. And you can be like a chess piece on the chessboard. But what I have found through all like Vision OS kind of things, this idea requires a very big room. Because if the chess pieces are life-size, that means that each square is like a couple feet wide.
Yeah.
And all the Vision OS little like example rooms are not actually big enough for this idea. So that also kind of begs the question of, well, my living room probably isn't big enough either when you actually end up using it. So I don't know how this will end up working out, but I have like chess pieces in the model. So hopefully that like leads somewhere.
So not only big, but also presumably basically empty, right? Otherwise you can't step around safely to move the pieces around, right?
Yeah, my goal is like thinking you can use eye tracking to either like highlight the squares, because like depending on which square you're looking at, you can use eye tracking and then highlight them as like you're kind of looking at them. And then it could either pick which piece would move to that specific place, or like you tap the piece that you want to move, then tap whichever square you want to be in. But also, chess is really nice where you can like say the letter and the number and be like knight to e5. Mm. And it can just do that. So you don't even have to do the whole like eye and tap interaction. It could just be all voice-wise too.
Yeah, it's interesting how weirdly it's probably as hard to do voice stuff as it is to do eye tracking. Because it has eye tracking built into the system, or you know, certainly gesture tracking and so forth. Whereas voice recognition across many accents and dialects and languages, actually surprisingly hard these days. So yeah, good luck with that. But I haven't been to a lab at all myself. I was away on vacation the entire time, so I might try and get to one in September perhaps. But I'm curious, listeners, you know, if you have not been to a Vision Pro lab, why not? You're just not interested in Vision Pro, nothing near to you, not no code ready. I'd love to know why. In the meantime, elsewhere in the news, Apple has now published a list of APIs that require reasons during app review. This is a new thing in iOS 17, well, slash updates to the App Store process, where when you use certain kinds of APIs now, before you could just use them freely, now you must tell Apple why you want to use them. Now, some of these, I think, are straightforward and safe. For example, when you want to know how much disk space is free on the user's device. That seems private, sensitive, potentially identifiable maybe, I'm not sure. Fine, ask, tell Apple why you're doing that, it makes sense. But other ones I'm less sure about. For example, they've said that all of user defaults now requires a reason for Apple, like why using user defaults. And I think, isn't that basically the most common API for just storing quick bits of data?
Yeah, that's definitely the API I used for my very first app. I made a trivia app. And of course, I wanted to store what's the high score, how many questions have you answered, right. How many are correct. Exactly. I put all of that in user defaults because it's easy. Hmm. And you can just like say, hey, here's the key. Number, total, correct answers, store it. And then that's it. So having to explain why I had to do that was, this is the easiest API for a very simple prototype. I don't know if that's an acceptable answer, but that was my answer.
Well, particularly because of like SwiftUI wraps in app storage. It doesn't even say user default. It just say app storage, this thing. And now you've got to say, why isn't the app storage property wrapper? It's an odd choice. And I'm a bit worried that, because you can save data anyway. You can save it to a file, JSON, codable. You can save it to Swift Data or Core Data. The same data can be saved anywhere, realistically. Mm-hmm. But only user defaults requires an explanation. I don't quite know why. I wondered whether it's because of the whole suite system. So you can have app data shared between an app group with a widget and a main app and a, I don't know, Siri K extension or keyboard extension. I'm not sure what it might be, but that's the only thing I can think of, is that you're sharing it between many parts of your app. But you can do the same with app groups and Swift Data. I don't know.
Yeah, it's interesting that it's something that, like you said, it's a property wrapper that we just easily can use in Swift UI that we now have to say something, versus like photos makes complete sense. I need access to photos to do X, Y, Z. But saying, oh, I need access to use this property wrapper, which is really just saving a small piece of data that's literally only a few bytes because you're not even supposed to save a lot of data in it. Mm-hmm. That's kind of odd.
Yeah.
But we'll see. I wonder if they'll say anything more about the reasoning behind it, because they said it's going to be implemented fall of this year, which means probably all new iOS 17 apps, but also I don't know when the cutoff is for when they'll require older apps also to start adding that. Is it like an info plist entry?
Yeah. We'll find out real soon now, I guess. But it's just strange because, as you say, it's things like high score or have I shown the first run screen, yes or no. It's really trivial information by design. Otherwise, it slows your app down. So, yeah, we're gonna see. Speaking of iOS 17, we're now actually approaching the final release of Xcode 15, right? Which means iOS 17, macOS Sonoma, watchOS 10, macOS.
Lots of numbers.
TVOS, whatever. Yeah, there's a whole bunch of
different numbers.
They should just stick to one version number, shouldn't they, really? And they haven't done, which is a real shame. But we're getting close to the iOS 17 release date, right? So I'm wondering if folks have actually got any apps ready for submission for release day.
You have a dog.
Ah, and my dog has come in. You have apps for release day. Your apps for release day, my dog. Is that true? Really? Or you just want a treat? Oh, dear me.
Aww.
See, listeners, folks, even I'm trying to record podcast stuff, dogs still come in looking for treats.
They heard iOS 17. They know it's
they
a hot new thing.
And they're totally psyched by Swift Data and more.
Tipkit.
But I think it's been a really great... Oh, Tipkit, yeah. It's been a great beta cycle because of things like Tipkit landing very late in the beta cycle. Things like Swift Data evolving so much in the beta cycle. And I've seen changes to Swift UI. I've seen weird last-ish minute changes to Swift UI to make things better. I'm like, where's that come from? Why are they doing that now? It's great, but wow. And so it's been an interesting beta cycle. So I'm wondering if folks are ready to submit for the big day whenever it's announced, probably in a week or two from now.
I know. I saw, I believe it was the Ice Cubes app for the open source Mastodon client. I believe he was able to move his app to the beta and build it. And he had like very minimal build errors, just going for like iOS 17, which is really nice because as opposed to when you have a million build errors when you open in like a beta or something, and then all of a sudden you have to like fix your whole app because 100 warnings and errors pop up.
Yeah, it's always the warnings about deprecations and stuff. And that's always, it just feels like make work, you know? this code worked fine before. It's still going to work fine now. I've got to change to the new version that takes a Boolean extra property or parameter or something like that. And it's like, oh man, it's quite tiresome, but I'm going to let it work for some. And now onto our theme for this episode, which this time is an interesting, sensitive topic. We ask, what's the worst code you've ever written? And this sounds dangerous because no one wants to admit to writing bad code, but I think it's a good thing to think about because actually everyone looks at the code you write on YouTube or I write in my YouTube or whatever, and it's easy to think, oh, they've nailed it, they've cracked it, they're getting it right first time. But actually, last year before, for me, 20 years ago, whatever it was, I've written some pretty horrifying code because sometimes you only know what good code looks like when you've written some bad code first. And so I think it's useful for everyone to say, oh yeah, here's examples I've made of where I completely screwed up. Here, and here. It's normal. You'll screw up too. Normalize making mistakes. Normalize screwing things up and learning from that and progressing. And rather than sort of pulling the ladder up after us and saying, yeah, I've always been this good. I'm always where I am today. So do you want to go first or shall I go first with bad code? What's the worst code you've ever written?
We wrote these down before the episode, and yours are some pretty good ones. So I want to hear yours
by
first.
By good, you mean bad, right? You mean terrible.
Yes.
So I'm not start with the absolute worst. I'll start with some example bad stuff. I mean, the very first iPhone project I worked on was a flashcards app. And I had no idea how Interface Builder worked. I did not understand at all how it worked. And as you'll know, when you use IB, if you make a connection from IB to your code, you get an IB output, an IB action. And at runtime, Objective-C / iOS, whatever, verifies the connection's still there. Is the IB output actually there? If it isn't, when it pulls apart the zip file, you get a crash. And I had no idea what was happening here. I'd make connections, break them, delete the code, whatever. It would crash. And it would become a hideous chunk of code. I had no idea what I was doing. There was a massive amount of duplication, massive amounts of dead code. It was completely clueless. It did ship. It got in the App Store eventually. It took a while because I called it Flashzilla. And Apple saw the word Flash and were very worried I was doing Adobe Flash or Macromedia Flash at the time. I had to go through App Review a few times. But it did ship eventually. And I'm pleased it shipped because I obviously went to do many more since then. But it was a pretty hideous program. And I have thought maybe I should release the code onto GitHub. The original untouched, you know, 10, 12-year-old code, whatever it is, saying, here you go. Look at my hideous code. Isn't it bad? Just to show folks that it's normal.
Yes, I would love to see that. But also, because you said it was the very first iPhone, that means it's also Objective-C code.
Oh,
so
yeah.
Me and others as well probably can't even read parts of it because we don't know Objective-C.
I probably can't read parts of it anymore because it's so bad at the time. There was a long time that I made a game for iPhone iOS 3 or iPhone OS 3 at the time. And I more or less refused to learn Objective-C. And so I wrote my code as, here is the slimmest, like thinnest, tiniest amount of Objective-C code that backs on to some cross-platform C++ code I've written elsewhere for Xbox, for Windows Mobile, for other, like for SDL and Linux, and now for iPhone as well. And it was all a sort of mishmash of code with just enough Objective-C to talk to it. That was also pretty hideous. I mean, it's really bad code, really atrocious war crimes level code.
I one time, this was once upon a time before I did iOS, I was writing a bash script, which maybe you can do this now, or maybe you always could, and I just didn't know this. It took me 3 days to just write code to figure out what day was yesterday. All I had to do was figure out what day was yesterday. And typically, if you're in like Swift or something, you can just do like date minus one day, and then there you go, you have yesterday. It would take you 5 minutes. But when I was writing this in Bash, it took me 3 days to figure it out because I realized, oh yeah, yesterday, if you're on the first of a new month, yesterday could be four different options. It could either be the 28th, 29th, 30th, or 31st, depending on leap year and what month it was. So doing that logic, I think I go through all of the months of an if-else statement, if it's January, if it's February, and go through and figure out what day was yesterday.
The thing is, you say you just do this in Swift. It's quite hard in Swift too. Because you ought to use calendar and date and do it exactly right. Because I mean, the simple, naive way of doing it is say, okay, look, there's 86,004 seconds in a day. Subtract that from right now and check what day it is, right? But in practice, thanks to time zone, you know, summertime changes, you might find going back that number of seconds is still today. Because it's jump forward, jump backwards in time, it gets very messy very quickly. And so it's not easy to do well, I think. And that's why we use Apple's APIs. Let them handle the calendar pain over there. We'll just call that and everyone's happy.
Yes, definitely. Because manually figuring out just what day it was yesterday, thankfully it's something that was, I was always in the same time zone for like this program. So it wasn't like you were moving, like mobile devices move around and time zones change.
Right.
So other than having to deal with daylight savings time, I just had to figure out like what day was yesterday, which again, yeah, it's not hard, but it's also like it took a lot of code. And I was just like 3 days in, I was just like, why did this take me so long to do? I was just figuring out one thing.
Yeah. Would you like to know the absolute worst code I ever wrote? I mean, this is the worst code I ever wrote, I think.
Yes. What is it?
It's terrible. Some years ago, I produced a content management system for a magazine company. And the goal was to be able to let users create articles about reviews or news, whatever, and then take those and publish to the web or publish to Apple News at the time or Google AMP or even Adobe InDesign documents so you could lay out the text to magazines and similar. It was powerful behind the scenes. And the goal was to try and get everything done into one big CMS, which ended up being a huge chunk of code. It took me like 3 months to write. And I ended up with a system where the CMS was written in PHP. And the PHP code would generate JavaScript code. And the JavaScript code would generate HTML code. So the PHP made JavaScript, JavaScript made HTML. And there was awful good reason because when you think about it, you want a document of information that have like paragraph, 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 paragraph.
Of, yep.
You know, text box to fill in with stuff. You could move them around, you could delete them and so forth. It had to be dynamic HTML, dynamic JavaScript. It was a complete mess. It worked brilliantly. It was really great. You press a button, boom, you've got InDesign, you've got web page, you've got, you know, Google code, Google AMP and similar from one source. But the code was a disaster. And, you know, I was thinking about how I'd change it. I did end up changing it to be better in the end. But I follow the classic pathway of software development, and I still do it today, which is make it work, make it right, make it fast. Make it work, make it right, make it fast. And that was very much in the make it work phase. You know, just prove the concept is good. Prove your chess pieces fit into the 3D space you have, whatever. Prove the idea is sound and working and it's actually possible and plausible and whatever. I've done that. The next phase, I ended up making it right. I ended up pulling it all apart. I used React to do the JavaScript rendering, all nicely, much better in the end. But it was a process. So even though it's terrible code, I don't feel bad about it because it was a gigantic learning experience. It solved the problem beautifully, and it ended up being made better through React and more. So yeah, it worked out well, I think, in the end. But it was bad code, as that was.
That reminds me of the, I think it was some social experiment thing where it was a teacher told like 10 students, okay, make a pot like out of clay. And they told one group of students, okay, make the best pot that you can. So they had one try to do the best thing. And then they had another group of students who they could also just make a pot, but they were told to make as many iterations in a certain period of time. So they were trying to make 5, 10, 12 pots rather than just make a single one. And the one who did multiple iterations, theirs was better in the end rather than the people who were trying to just get it right the first time.
Absolutely. Practice makes perfect. So now you've heard my absolute worst code. Tell me. Give me some more Michaela bad code.
One of the worst ones I've done is like my very first app that I had, or first or second, it's actually the second one is still on the App Store, is it's an app to track your job applications. So when you're applying to a bunch of different jobs, you end up like submitting a million applications. So you sometimes want to track where you have submitted your app to different places. That app is still on the App Store for me. You can find it somewhere in the links that I have on the internet. But also, it's that one has in it a massive view controller. So for anyone who doesn't know, coming in UIKit, because this was in 2019, which was when SwiftUI was released, but I was still learning UIKit at the time. And they have a thing called Massive View Controllers, which is like a play on words for, what is it called?
MVC.
What's that called, though?
Model view controller?
That's it. I was like, what is it called? I can't remember. Model view controller.
It was so long ago, Michaela.
It really was.
Years ago.
Too many acronyms. Model view controller. Yeah, is what it's actually called. And so people call them massive view controllers because you end up actually putting all the code in the view controller rather than putting it in different places. But that's actually what the code is still, like, to this day on the App Store. Everything is, like, a majority of the app, it's all built in one view controller. Because it worked. And I shipped it, and I haven't updated it since then.
To be fair, there are worse things than massive view controller. You'll often find old projects, like, or beginner projects, which have massive app delegate. And that's when you know you've got a problem. You just dumped code in that one place again and again and again. Well, listen, folks. The moral of the story is everyone writes bad code. It is normal to write bad code. If you don't look on code you wrote 3, 4, 5 years ago and think that was terrible, have you really progressed? Have you really learned much since then? So I think it's okay to look back and say, I would solve things differently today based on what you've learned in the meantime. That's normal. It's okay. You have our blessing to go out and write horrible, horrifying, terrible code. Just don't necessarily ship all of it, or at least try and refine it before you do ship it, if possible.
Or update it later.
Or leave it to someone else to update.
The open ballot question that we asked everybody this time on social media is, do developers also need to be designers? And we have many answers. And surprisingly, unlike the last question we asked, a majority of people agree, which I think is maybe the first time ever this has happened in the developer community. We all agree on a topic.
There's no it depends?
There are, because we are developers. So there has to be an it depends. But one of the first people who we saw was that Dan O'Leary mentioned that it's a superpower to be able to be a designer and a developer. So do you need to be? Not necessarily, not technically, but there is a noticeable difference in apps that have an eye for design.
Yeah, so I guess the question is, what is an eye for design? Like, is that at least be able to say, I don't like that, but I can't describe why, or I can't make it better, at least knowing what's bad, maybe?
It could be that. And I think a big thing for iOS development specifically is knowing if an app is following the human interface guidelines. I immediately know in, like, any app that I use, I'm just like, oh, the touch target is too small on this button. I can't tap on the button. And it's something I immediately know. And everybody just randomly has 44 points committed to memory as the minimum touch target. And you will one day forget, like, why do I know that? Why is the number 44 significant? But you know it's ingrained somewhere.
It's like whenever you tap your phone to see what time it is, and it's like, it's 9:41. You're like, ooh, Apple time.
I do that. I'm like, it's 9:41. I'm like, wait, is it? Is my phone connected to my computer? Is that really what time it is? I don't know.
Speaking of touch targets, I was at SwiftConf a few weeks ago, just walking around at the after party, chatting to folks, and someone was showing off their app. And I walked past and said, what's an app? What's this then? And it was Crunchyroll, which I use to watch anime with my kids. And like, oh, you work on Crunchyroll. I have feedback for you. I went through, please fix this. Please fix this. Please fix this. And one of them was touch targets for the thing. It's just too small. If you're listening, that nice Crunchyroll person, I'm really sorry for bothering with my bugs, but please fix them because I use Crunchyroll a lot.
And it's funny that something such, like, so small as, like, a detail as the touch target, but it's something that everybody does notice, though, because you're like, I can't tap the button. It's too hard to do because that's all we do when we're using our phones. But it's something you immediately notice, and you can tell when somebody takes that into account or not, too.
Yeah. It actually surprised me when SwiftUI shipped because they had the chance then to say, buttons that is 44 points high, and didn't. You can still make tiny, tiny little buttons with SwiftUI, which is an unusual choice, I think. But anyway.
Yeah, Sean Allen mentions that it's undeniable that you're a more valuable asset to your team if you have a fundamental understanding of UI and UX as a developer, but it's not required. But he also mentions, too, it's learning the basics of UI, UX, user interface, user experience. It's not a heavy lift, so don't be lazy about it.
Yeah, don't be lazy, folks, says Sean. Not that we're judging you personally out there, listener. You, stop you being lazy. Come on.
And if you don't know what to do, you can always just use all the default Apple things, too. Because they design those in the way that you can just drop them into your project. It'll look like another kind of basic Apple app, but it will work, though, too. in following all their own guidelines because they were the ones who made these components. So if they don't follow those guidelines, you can blame Apple.
Absolutely. And I wish more folks did that because I often see like tutorials from folks saying, hey, let's make a custom animated tab bar. I'm like, no, don't do that. Don't do that. Their one works brilliantly. Their one has great support for voiceover and dynamic type and yada, yada, yada. And you can try and recreate the various functionality in there, but you'll miss some things. The most common example I have of this is if you have dynamic type turned on and you scale text up quite large into the larger sizes and go to a tab bar, if you press and hold the tab icon, it zooms up in the middle of the screen to see, oh, that's the music tab, that's the albums tab, artist tab, a big picture of it in the middle. For folks who can't read the small tab icons, there's all those little subtle things that Apple put in the work for you. Please use their stuff. They spent millions and millions of dollars building these great designs for you. Use those things, folks.
Definitely. And Anika Saibazeta also says that it's not that you have to learn everything before you start your journey, but just look at how other apps do certain things too. And so after some time, you start to get a feeling of how like an iOS app really works and how people use them and design them.
So would you say that you have a feeling when you're using a non-native app, like if someone's done a Flutter app or a
Oh, I can tell. Can you feel it? I feel like I am very bougie now about apps because I'm an iOS dev. I was just using the Qdoba app to order, you know, like Mexican food in America. And every time you switch a tab, instead of just showing the screen, it like slides it onto the stack, like under the tab bar. And I'm just like, why is this happening? I know what they're doing and how they made it do this. I'm just like, why? Why did they do it this way?
Yeah, there's a thing where big companies like Google think we want our apps to look the same on every platform, as if the users are switching between Android and iOS on a regular basis. Like, no one does that. No one has like different kinds of OS unless they're like testing as a full-time job. We don't do that. So just make it look for their device they have right now, make it fit well. And I've certainly found that if I'm thinking, you know, this app feels a little bit odd, I've learned a brilliant trick, which is that apparently it's a standard on Flutter. Flutter apps, if you scroll, it scrolls normally. Scroll with two fingers, it scrolls twice as fast. Three times as fast, four times. If you hold four fingers and scroll, if it scrolls really quickly, it's a Flutter app. You straight away you know it doesn't feel right. Try the whole four-finger scroll thing and you'll see if it scrolls fast or not. It's a Flutter app. I don't know why. It's weird.
Oh, that's funny. And that's funny you mentioned Google too, because I noticed that only after like being on YouTube, I use the community tab, because unless you're actually a creator, you're not really posting to a community. And in scheduling a post, the date time picker that they use in the YouTube app, calling out YouTube, I mean, they're a big corporation, so it's okay. Calling them out about it is they use the Android UI for that. It's like this clock looking thing and you have to like move the hands on the clock. And I was like, what is this? And I looked it up and somebody was like, oh yeah, that's the default date picker that's in Android in Material Design. And I was like, and they put it in the iOS app? Like, really?
And the best bit is,
Apple made one of these.
Yeah, it's not shipping with the built-in OS, right? So they've had to actually ship all the SDK and API to make that happen, all the graphics, all the code, as well as the built-in stuff. They're like, no, have our different stuff instead. It's like, great, so your app is now 200 megabytes, including JavaScript and who knows what, plus custom stuff. Oh, thanks for that, Google.
Oh, it was shocking. I was like, what? What is this? But then Clarko also mentions that all developers are designers, though. Even a command line tool has an interface that may be judged as more or less intuitive.
Right. So this is where we get into the area of design, not just being pixels you see on the screen. How you interact with something, you know, the command line options you pass, the feedback you get back out, how you actually work your way through the thing. And that is actually, for me, a more significant area of design than just pixels, because I can't do pixels. I'm terrible at Photoshop. I can barely use After Effects. I'm quite clueless. But I do very strongly feel frustrating user experience or non-smooth user experience. And when it's right, like when it's great, you're like, yeah, it feels fantastic. And so I've definitely got a sharp eye for that, but not so much on the pixel side.
Sebastian DeVith says that he also agrees with Clarko about development is design by definition. So should developers be visual designers? He doesn't think so, but one should follow your own interests and talents, much like all designers shouldn't try to be full-time coders.
Yeah, so listeners, Sebastian is the designer behind the Lux apps, or at least one of the designers behind the Lux apps, working on Halide and similar. He's done a lot of work at Apple as well. He really knows his design. It's a really aspirational level for the rest of us to work at Sebastian's level. And this is, again, that definition, that split between design as pixels and design as experience is a big one here. And it's something I think we can definitely care about more as developers.
Yeah, and when you have like something that is very like well designed and it just works, that's the magic of it, is you went through like some onboarding or something and you're like, oh wow, that was really easy. Making something look easy is difficult.
Yeah, yeah. I can safely talk about this now. I think everyone's seeing it, but the Vision Pro onboarding experience has you do two things, one of which is to look at a circle of dots on the screen. You sort of look at each circle going around the way, looking at different sides to align your eyes correctly, so it tracks eye correctly. Another one is to hold your hands out in front of you so you can measure your hands and arm length and get a space of how your reach is like when you're interacting with the world. And both are seconds of things to do for a user. They take hardly any time at all. But they must have gone through so many iterations again and again and again and again. Simplify, 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 simplify. And end up with hardly anything. End up with like a tiny little thing that feels trivial, but that's a version 1,000 of the system. And this is one thing Apple does very, very well with things like their laptops and their phones, similar. You think, oh, the laptop is like a silver slab with some black keys. Yeah, but to get to that point and make removing this, fixing this, optimizing this, tweaking this, to simplify, 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 boil it down, refine, 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 get right to the core of it. And it's hard to do. It's very hard to do.
Yeah, and imagine if the Vision Pro, if they just assumed where your hands would be, because that would be really weird of a user experience, really, because like my arm is shorter than probably your arms are, Paul. So if they just assumed what the length of where your hands typically would end up being, that would be really weird because it would only maybe sometimes detect where my hand is versus where yours is because your arms are just longer than mine.
Yes, and my gigantic orangutan arms I have, Michaela. Yes, they're just huge.
It is in comparison, if you're talking to comparison to me, who's also like 6 inches shorter
move
than you.
Move on.
And then Craig Hockeyberry, he said it's all about design and there is a spectrum from architecture to interaction to interface. So some developers work towards the end of the spectrum, some are in the middle, but the best developers have a breadth over the spectrum. So all developers should know where they lie on that spectrum and get help in areas where they are the weakest.
And where do you lie in the spectrum, do you think?
I would say I'm definitely more on like an architecture, not like the UI kind of side, because I can drop in Apple components and use them in that way. But I also don't have that like pixel perfect of, oh, wow, that looks so much better if you just made these like rounded quarters or it looks so much better if you just change the colors, because colors and topography have such a dramatic impact on something.
It's true.
So I can't like do that very well, but I can also somewhat organized code in a certain way, but I can do more logic kind of things more so than the UI UX.
Yeah. It's interesting if you ask someone like how they rate themselves as a developer, we tend to reach for how well do I write code? Like, I'm a great writing code, whatever, 10 out of 10, 8 out of 10, whatever. When actually writing code's a fairly small part of our job sometimes. Like how well you communicate with other people to hear their requirements, hear their adjustments, hear their requests, feedback on that and help them get towards their goal matters. Again, the design stuff matters. It's a number of things combined at the same time to produce a good developer, not just how good you are at code. And I think I'd rather have someone who is sort of like a solid 7 out of 10 at communication and coding and design than 10 out of 10 at coding and then, you know, 2 out of 10 at communication and 2 out of 10 at design, you know, had no idea how to talk to folks and couldn't design for anything, but could write code really well. I'm not sure that's necessarily valuable.
Craig also mentioned too that he would add that developers often think that they use software like an average person. We don't. We don't use software like an average person. And then that's where like interaction and visual design is essential. It's the thing that he values the most with the folks that he works at the Icon Factory.
This is a hard one to swallow, but it is painfully, painfully true. And listeners, if you've got a boyfriend or girlfriend or husband or wife or whatever, some close relative next to you who is not a geek, just use their phone for 48 hours and you'll find it the most frustrating experience possible. And even with my wife, I used her phone for a few days. When was it? It was an early beta. I didn't want to break my phone or something like that, so I had to use her phone for a little bit just to make sure it will work correctly. I had a problem with the phone. It kept saying, re-enter your Google password. And she's like, oh, don't worry. Just press cancel when that appears. It's like every hour. She just presses cancel again and again and again while I'm fixing the underlying thing. Like, you just don't do it. Nope, I leave it like that the entire time. it's things they accept that we would never accept. They grind us down when I fix it straight away. And I'm like, no, it's fine. Leave it. Just press cancel. Just do that thing. That's how it works. Part of the features. And we don't see that, I think. We tend to use it in such a precise, optimized, in our head way that we don't see it at all like, well, the muggles do out there, quite frankly, normal people who don't make code all day, you know?
Yeah, I've had that where I had a friend who I was beta testing his app, and I was just like going through, I'm like, oh yeah, this looks good to me. It makes complete sense, because I would tap everything on the screen. And then he had said like a couple months or weeks or so later, I was like, oh yeah, people haven't realized that you can tap this one thing. And I was like, really? You just do it? And he was like, no, well, people don't see that you can do that. You're doing it because you're a developer and you will try to tap everything. And so it's just like, we use our phones differently, whether you realize it or not, we do.
Yeah, and there's been some great talks about this in the past. I remember one from a long time ago from, cranky, this might have been Novell. Like, it was, I think, Nat Friedman when his company's Zimian was acquired by Novell. Anyway, can't show age slightly here. And I was talking about, they did user testing of like how users use their email app. And they found it baffling. They just like press the icon again and again and again, like to get to write a new mail. And that's not the new mail icon. That's the fetch mail icon. Doesn't matter. They press it again and again. It's not working. Why is it not working? And then Dave Verwer gave a talk a few years ago at iOS Dev UK where he said how to do reviews of your app with users, how to ask them how they use your app and what they like. An example he gave was, have you seen this feature? That's a question. Answer, yes, we use it all the time, love it. And they looked at the logs and like, this user's never actually touched that feature at all. How are they possibly saying that? It turns out the user was basically finding a bizarre alternate path through all the other features to do the same thing, rather than the baked-in, built-in button to do that thing. They find this other way, and oh, it's great, we can just do this. Okay. But until you ask, you don't realize how these people are using your tools.
They took a side quest.
A few folks actually picked out developers who they think make great design. Michael recommended David Smith, who makes Widget Smith, obviously a hugely popular widget app for your phone. Brandon recommended Shihab Mahabu, who makes Vinyls, beautiful, and Race Control, beautiful, beautiful. Tyler recommended Daniel Gautier, who makes Up Ahead. So go and check out these apps, folks. You know, it's really great to get inspiration from other indie apps. Go and support them by trying their apps and give them a review if you could. But see what they're doing. Learn from them what they're doing well and doing badly and get ideas.
And then Roddy Munro mentions that he definitely thinks that the developers should have an eye for design, but your app could do the most amazing thing, but if it has poor design, people won't want to use it.
And that brings us to the end of the episode. Thanks for listening, folks. Of course, leave a review, tell your friends, subscribe. And next time, our open ballot's going to be, what is your best advice for interviews, whether it's technical, behavioral, whatever it is, when someone's going for a developer job, what is your best advice for those interviews? Let us know, post a question on social media in a week or two, let us know a reply there, and we'll feature the best in the next episode. Until then, take care, folks.
See ya.
Okay. Dogs, get out. Out.
They can open the door?
They can. Yeah, with the noses. They just walk on in. They've got no shame.